I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. Late last week, a surveillance camera on the border between Arizona and Mexico recorded what appears to be a U.S. border agent shooting and killing an illegal immigrant. The dead man has not been identified. The agent is on leave with pay pending an investigation. And once again, the controversy over illegal Mexican immigrants continues. Just like the arguments over fences and border patrols, there is very little common ground here. Some say that the U.S. reluctance to clamp down and control the 2,000 miles of its southern border has resulted in the Southwest being overrun by Mexican immigrants, and worse, that these Mexicans are not assimilating or making the sorts of contributions that have earned every other immigrant his or her place in America. But others argue that those are the same racist jibes that met the Irish and the Poles and others who came to America 100, 150 years ago. Connection listeners, immigrants from Mexico are unlike those from Asia and Europe. All they have to do is step across a border. Does that mean there should be a separate and specific policy for Mexicans? Or should the rules be the same for everyone? And if so, is this country prepared to do what it would really take to control that border with Mexico? Our number is 1-800-423-TALK. 1-800-423-8255. Now, in a couple of minutes, we'll talk with two people who have written extensively on migration from Mexico. But first, let's go to Tombstone, Arizona, and talk with Chris Simcox. Chris is the founder of Civil Homeland Defense. That's a citizen border patrol group that operates in Cochise County, Arizona. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Chris, the work that you do patrolling the border, is that a full-time job for you?
It's a full-time job for the organization. I just completed 3 days this weekend of patrolling the border.
So you do it more as a volunteer?
Yes, this is a volunteer organization based on the Citizens Corps Initiative presented by the president for Americans to be alert. It's a neighborhood border watch group, and we report suspicious illegal activity along the border to help Border Patrol.
You had 3 days on the border this past weekend. What were you doing? What happened?
Well, what we do, especially at this time of the year, that we patrol and more of a search and rescue operation where we're also wanting to help people who may be stranded or have been victimized by the smugglers or the coyotes. This weekend, we came across 13 Brazilians who were being smuggled on Friday night and who were had very little water, and I think they were very happy to see us, although they were quite disappointed that that was the end of their trip as we turned them over to Border Patrol. And that's an everyday thing, sir. This is not so much just about the Mexican immigrants that want to come here and work. This is about OTMs. There are people from all over the world that we've come across in the last 8 months walking into our country.
OTMs, Chris?
Other than Mexican, this is about national security, and we're demanding that our federal government bite the bullet, take the, you know, the world's changed since September 11th. We want military on the border for a short time until we have a mutual respect with Mexico and America, that we respect each other's border laws and that we come in through authorized ports of entry.
Now, I just read over the weekend that, 150 new agents were hired, helicopters, Humvees have been added to the Border Patrol. Is that going to be enough, or will there always have to be people like you who do this on a voluntary basis?
We hope that there are other things that we could be volunteering for in our communities, and we could be volunteering to help migrant workers assimilate when they come here. We could help them find jobs after American citizens are put to work. But we hope that we need to send an edict to Mexico, stop violating our borders. Yes, we can allow workers to come in, and we can have a sane, responsible guest worker program, and we need that. However, what's going on now is only going to cause more misunderstandings, as we've seen, and more lives being lost needlessly.
Chris, tell me a little bit about the people who do this, because I've heard two separate stories. One, that it's important that the U.S. establish proper border controls, and until that's done, folks like yourself will take, you know, the responsibility to do that in the nation's interest. But the other thing that I've heard is that people are just really sick of having their fences cut or their backyards littered or people, you know, wandering through their towns. And that's why people are becoming involved. What's the real story?
That's true. I mean, after 10 years or more of it of increased illegal immigration through people's backyards, now we have people dying in the desert in people's backyards, and it's just something that the citizens here are fed up with, and our angst is with the United States government, not with Mexico. Although Mexico has a great deal of responsibility in providing for its citizens, as well as our government does. And these two governments need to work together to solve the problems of the crime and the trespassing. I mean, this is about private property rights as well.
Right. That, and just, you know, from your own perspective, Chris, is it a neighborhood issue? Is it, you know, keeping your neighborhood secure, not having those people through that motivate you? Or is it that, preventing the illegal crossing of the border on a larger scale? What motivates you?
Well, certainly it's both. First, it's national security. When you're out here as much as we have been and come across people from Poland and from China and from Brazil and all over the world, you know that it would be so easy for someone out there who does want to hurt this nation to walk right through our back door and right into someone's community and cause harm. And then we have the environmental harm. We have natural areas here that are basically destroyed because of the amount of foot traffic and the human waste left behind by people that come in. So it certainly affects us locally and nationally. It's very systemic all the way through our societies and on both sides of the border. And people should not have to sneak in to get a minimum wage job and be taken advantage of by the American free enterprise system. They should want to come through legally, healthy, and know where their job is going to be and know that they're going to walk, with their head held high with respect that people are not going to suspect them of being illegal.
Chris, thanks for your time.
Certainly. Thank you very much.
Chris Simcox is founder of Civil Homeland Defense. He was on the line from Tombstone, Arizona. Joining us now, two people who write on immigration from a very personal point of view. Victor Davis Hanson's the author of the recent book, Mexifornia, A State of Becoming. He's also a professor of classics at California State University in Fresno. And Ricardo Pimentel is a syndicated columnist with the Arizona Republic, and he's also on the editorial board there. He's joining us from the NPR studio in Phoenix, Arizona. Gentlemen, welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Victor, I wonder if I can start with you and ask you about a character who you feature in the beginning of your book, Mexifornia, the fellow by the name of Santiago Lara, because he seems to sort of represent an example that's useful for you. Is that a fair way of characterizing it?
Yes, I wrote the book from the viewpoint of almost everybody involved, from the Mexican government to the employers to the undocumented workers themselves, and I looked at this life cycle of the illegal immigrant that seems to be so prevalent where I live.
Tell me how you first met Santiago Lara.
Well, I was teaching and on the tractor one day, and he pulled in my yard and he asked for a job, and he had I-9 forms and the whole thing, and so we talked to him, and pretty soon he had nowhere really to stay, and one thing led to another, and his children now are legal, and two of them in their 40s, late 30s, and they live next to my brother, and so we've sort of become two close families. But when he first came, he was very young, and he worked hard in town at cement, made odd jobs on the weekends doing agricultural work, and then I've watched him over the last decades. Age, he doesn't speak English, he didn't get access to education, his children didn't finish high school, even though they work very hard, and he's representative of a whole life cycle where people come from Oaxaca or central Mexico, they work hard. By the time they've done this for 20 or 30 years, and I didn't meet him when he first came, I met him after he'd been here a while,
right.
And they have leg problems, anybody would who works with shingles or cement or agriculture, their back goes out, and then at 50, 53, 54, the entitlement industry has to pick up from the employer because the employer suddenly says this person doesn't work as hard, so then there's workman's comp, disability, help with housing, food, and then the employer says, well, his kids who have never been to Mexico in some cases don't want to work as hard. Only 4 out of 6 of 10 second generation or first generation Hispanic children are graduating from high school. And then they say, let's go get another cohort from Mexico to do this work, and we start the cycle over again. And in the meantime,
you're using him in the book as an example of people who aren't assimilating the way that the classic immigration.
Well, I say that they're assimilating, but it's taking not one or two, but sometimes two and three generations, because the pool of immigrants is so large, and they come under illegal auspices where, in reaction to that, instead of going back to the old American assimilation melting pot theory, we try to create an alternate legal universe that can range from driver's license to people here who are here illegally to in-state tuition for children who are illegal aliens in an attempt to solve the problem. And because of the sheer numbers, it doesn't give us enough time to assimilate people as we did in the past.
Okay, let's turn to Ricardo Pimentel, because Ricardo, in your own writing, you too use a very personal story to describe the way that Latinos are settling in the United States, your own family.
That's right. Let me give you another example, a counter to Santiago Lara. That'd be my father, Rodolfo Pimentel, who was a tailor, immigrated to this country when he was a young man, met my mother here, and retired in his late 60s, as most Americans do. Was no drain on the U.S. economy, was a provider. He paid taxes, he raised with his wife, my mother, three sons, all U.S. citizens, one a lawyer, one a journalist, one owns his own business. And I don't think our story is all that unusual. We are, I think, a fairly good example of assimilation. A RAND Corporation study just came out, said that Latino immigration, its levels of assimilation, the speed of assimilation, mimics previous immigrant waves from the Italians, the Irish, the Jews, the Poles. And within three generations, first generation being the immigrant, the second generation being their children, the third generation being their children, we are 10% off what the third generation income for white males. So it's fairly consistent.
But it's still a competition of stories in one way, because you have the stories like that of Santiago Lara, you have the story of your own family, and it's kind of a tense conversation, it seems to me, Ricardo.
It is a emotion laden conversation. I would credit Professor Hansen for having gotten to know the culture. I think most people who spout off about this issue don't know the culture.
Let me just stop you there, if I can, Ricardo. We have to take a very short break. We'll be back to talk more about your experience and that of Victor David Hansen as we look at the current state of Mexican immigration into the United States, and ask Connection listeners to join us. Does the proximity of Mexico to the United States mean that there ought to be a special policy? Is this something both governments actually really need to get involved with, and quickly? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. In this hour, a conversation about immigration from Mexico to the United States. This is the time of the year when it tends to increase in anticipation of summer work. People move north into Texas and New Mexico and Arizona and California looking for work. With us on the program today, Ricardo Pimentel. He is a syndicated columnist who writes about social justice, Latino issues, education, and other matters. And he's also a member of the editorial board at the Arizona Republic. He's joining us from Phoenix. Victor Davis Hansen is author of a book called Mexifornia, A State of Becoming. He is a professor of classics at Cal State University in Fresno, and he lives on the same vineyard and orchard near Selma, California, where he was born. I've got that right, haven't I, Victor? That,
yes, you do.
Fifth generation, if I'm not mistaken, right?
I am.
And tell me then, if you can, how you've seen, in your lifetime, Selma, California change.
Well, when I grew up, it was about 6,000 to 7,000 people, and it was about 75% Mexican-American or first-generation Mexican. I went to a school where there was five non-Mexican children, including my brother, and there was the assimilation model. There was no bilingual education. There was no La Raza studies. There was not very much illegal immigration. It was mostly either through guest worker programs or legal. And that generation, I think Mr. Pimentel is absolutely right, that generation who came of age are now running the town very well, policemen, firemen, city council, businessmen, teachers. But we lost confidence in that model in the 70s, where we introduced, I think it was a good faith effort, but we introduced bilingual education in the schools, separatist curricula in some cases, the collapse of Mexico in the early 80s. So suddenly this town is now about 19,000, 23,000. And we don't know how many people are here legally. We have no idea, except 2 miles where I live, there's an apartment building that's almost 100% illegal aliens. And they come here to work, but they're not assimilating. And even the statistics that Mr. Pimentel used, I think, are probably correct. 3 generations, the third generation makes only 10% less than the so-called dominant culture, but right, that's still a 60-year period. And the problem is it just doesn't people come, but it's a large, large number. So if it takes 60 years to reach equity, somebody somewhere needs to work on it, because we have no idea how many illegal aliens are here in California, for example. It could be 2, it could be 3. One of the fascinating things about the subject is the use of statistics. You can talk to conservatives who will swear to you that the average illegal alien takes $50,000 more in services from the state of California over his lifetime than he contributes in taxes. You can talk to somebody very liberal and says, no, he contributes about $11,000 more in taxation than he takes in entitlement. So we really don't know what's going on, but we have to. I'm just doing it. I just look at the problem, the complexity, empirically from my own community and my own family, which is my brother is married to a Mexican woman, and my other brother has Mexican-American stepchildren. Both my daughters are now, one's engaged to a son of an illegal alien. So it's a very complex issue.
And why is it more than an issue? Why is it a problem? What would be the one thing that you'd point to for people who don't live in your town? What do we need to understand?
Well, there's about 4 or 5 things that I'm very worried about. In California, Hispanics are graduating from high school. We all have these wonderful anecdotal stories, pro and con, but we look at statistics. 3 to 4 Hispanic students are not graduating from high school. Of the Hispanic population in California, somewhere around 10 to 15% have bachelor's degrees. If we look at the legislation to correct that, we're now discussing giving licenses to illegal immigrants, which just undermines the entire legality of bringing a birth certificate when you come of age. Or I have Mexican-American citizens from Arizona and Nevada who pay 3 times the tuition at our state than people who are living illegally in California. So that undermines the principle or the egalitarianism or the idea of legality. If you look at some of our prison population.
Would it be accurate for me to sort of draw a big circle around it and say it is the state's ability to manage the people within the state, whether or not we're talking about schools or hospitals, prisons? Is that the sort of umbrella of concern that you have here?
That and a public level. I mean, California, if we look at it a minute, it has 2 of the great ports of the world in Portland and Los Angeles. It has Hollywood. It has Yosemite. It's got the richest agricultural area in the world. It's got Silicon Valley. It's got a wonderful climate. And it's $34 billion in the deficit. That's not just because of entitlements, but it is mostly a problem of state spending that rose over the last 8 years at 40%. So we have enormous problems. And the problem I have with immigration is the discourse, because if you discuss it, people in agribusiness on the right talk as if you're naive about economics or you're a protectionist, and people on the left and what I sometimes call the race industry in the university call you a racist. And in between, we have people who in some ways have their lawns cut by illegal aliens, or they'll go down to El Camino Real in Palo Alto in Silicon Valley, pick up illegal aliens, take them, have them build a deck for the day, then dump them off back on the street. So everybody partakes in this, and we don't want to be honest about the problem.
Let me, if I can, bring Ricardo in here, Ricardo, because when we talk about what's happening with in today's towns and cities in California and Arizona, is there a problem that needs to be fixed?
There are problems attendant with immigration. It has to do with lack of education and poverty. However, let's pretend that the conservatives are right and that there is not a surplus between benefits and what they pay. And who's going to do the work? The fact is, we talk about the push from Mexico, but we don't talk enough about the pull. That even if these folks were not here, we would have to find a way, invent a way to get them here, because our economy needs them. And I think it is contradictory and a little bit hypocritical to insist that we need them, but that we're not willing to do what it takes to help them assimilate. And they do assimilate quickly. I am the son of immigrants. I'm a U.S. Navy veteran. I'm a taxpayer. I haven't been in trouble with the law. I think a tiny sliver of immigrants run afoul of the law, the criminal law, and that it is not at all representative of the general population who just put their heads down and work and try to hide while they do it.
Ricardo, let me ask you, though, about one of the sort of central recommendations in Victor's book, and that is that it's a border. It's another country. The border and the people there ought to be treated just like folks who might want to immigrate from India or from Bangladesh and go through that process. What would change if that were to be the case, if the United States were to make all the moves necessary there?
Well, you talked earlier about the need for a special relationship, and I agree with that. The fact of life is that we are an industrial power, and we are bordered on the south by a third world power, a third world country. And that creates some pushes and some pulls. And if we develop a sane immigration policy that recognizes that the economy needs the workers, that Mexico needs the outlet, mm-hmm. Then I think we could go a ways in eliminating undocumented immigration. Several elements of that plan might be a guest worker program. I happen to think amnesty, recognizing the folks who are here and their contributions, would be a part of that.
All these were things that were, in fact, being talked about between the two presidents prior to September 11th, 2001, and then, of course, in the weeks after that, none of this was.
That's right, and basically the same folks who argued about closed borders before 9/11 are the same folks who are arguing about it afterward, except this time they are saying national security, and I think it's a issue of convenience for many people.
All right, let's open it up and bring some of our callers in. We have a number, 1-800-423-8255 is the number to call us, and we'll go first to Cary, North Carolina. Shannon's on the line. Hi, Shannon.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I own a landscaping company. Approximately 80% of my employees are Mexican. I have very few Americans apply for jobs with the company, and that's true of all the companies around me. The ones who are here legally find that they have to pay exorbitant bribes on the Mexican side of the border to get the documentation to get across the border legally. Once they are here, there are so many changes in the forms to INS that they are making multiple trips to INS to try and update their status and keep everything legal here. And I'm wondering if we couldn't design a system to simplify the legal work permit process so that they are allowed to provide job documentation after arriving here in the U.S. You mentioned a special policy. I think if we can simplify the process of bringing them across the border legally, we can eliminate some of the deaths that we're seeing that are just breaking my heart.
Shannon, let me ask you a couple of quick questions. Of the of the Mexican workforce that you have, do you know how many of them are there with all the necessary legal papers, and how many of them are in that class of undocumented immigrants?
They all provide me with legal documentation.
I mean, they all have the papers, but
yes.
Do you know whether or not they're all good? Because
I mean, do not.
Yeah. And now, the other thing I want to ask you is, you say Americans won't apply for the jobs. Is it simply a matter of wages, that the business is so competitive that Americans don't want to work? Well, I don't know. What do you pay these guys, for example?
Starting is $8 an hour. I have salaried employees who make a very nice salary. I actually pay them higher than I pay myself right now.
Why aren't Americans applying for those jobs?
Because I think of the stigma attached to it. I find very few Americans want a job where you're digging in the dirt and out in the sun all day long. And the ones who do apply, I've had a couple of Americans apply for a foreman position with no experience, no credentials whatsoever. One in particular who'd just gotten out of jail. I'm not seeing a qualified American workforce apply for these jobs. I am seeing an experienced Mexican workforce applying for these jobs.
Shannon, thank you so much for your call.
You're welcome.
I want to go to Victor Davis Hanson on this. I can almost hear you banging your head on the table when Shannon talks about Americans not wanting to apply for these jobs, because I know that's something that frustrates you as well.
It does. She makes a very good point, and I think that we have to realize, though, that wasn't always true. When I was in grammar school, we started the school 2 weeks late. We all went out and made our school clothes picking grapes or working in the fields. Everybody did. It's an irony that people who do complain about illegal immigration, you can go, we say in Central California, we need 30,000 undocumented workers for the grape harvest, and then there's at least that many teenagers who are in the mall at that very moment. But it doesn't mean that situation has to be there forever. If we would have some honesty to it, to everybody involved and every side of the issue, and say, let's reduce the amount of immigration, not cut it off completely, but let's reduce the amount, have a small guest worker program, allow the people who do want to come here come legally, and then we would put the responsibility back on Americans and say, you wanted this, let's see if you're willing to work, and if you're not... But one of the tragic
I wonder
things
if you
is,
can put that cat back in the bag, though, whether or not you can persuade people to cut their own grass and babysit their own kids and be the cooks and the house cleaners.
I think it's incumbent to try, because the minimum wage would have to be raised considerably. The cost of everything would go up 2 or 3%. But there would also be some benefits. There wouldn't be these discussions we're having about, do you have a separate legal system for driver's license, for school tuition? 25% of the California inmate population, people think, we don't know for sure, are illegal immigrants. So it's not just, there is a crime problem that's not commiserate with the actual numbers in strict percentages.
Ricardo, I heard you trying to get in here just on the cutting the grass and cleaning the houses issue.
Well, I mean, the Labor Department makes estimates that over the next decade, our labor needs will increase, not decrease. And it has to do with the demographics of aging. We're aging. We're going to need workers. We're going to need young workers. And so the cat is out of the bag, and the genie is out of the bottle, however you want to put it, and it's not going back in.
All right, we will talk a little bit further on in the hour about what the options are that Shannon was asking about, but I do want to try and get in a couple of other callers before we go there. Our number is 1-800-423-8255 to Raleigh, North Carolina now, and Brian's on the line. Hi, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Basically, I've gone to school here in Wake County, North Carolina,
yep,
for culinary arts, and recently when applying for a job at a restaurant. And I'd like to add, this wasn't a Mexican restaurant. It was a local restaurant that had a rotating menu, a very nice restaurant. I won't name the restaurant. I wasn't considered for the job as a pastry chef because I didn't speak fluent Spanish. Apparently everyone in the kitchen did. I'm assuming they were all illegal aliens. And apparently it's because they were willing to work for less money. And, you know, I go to school here. I, you know, take classes to be a pastry chef. I pay taxes. It's my career of choice.
Yeah.
And, you know, what do I do?
Brian, who do we blame for that? I mean, you can hardly blame the people who are willing to work for less, But on the other hand, what's an employer to do?
Exactly. I don't think that he's doing anything illegal. I think it's irresponsible. But, you know, if that's the choice he has to make to stay in business, it puts a real problem on the whole situation. You know, so I'm looking at either starting a business or accepting lower wages. So
it's a real simple solution.
Go ahead.
Pay everybody $30 an hour, you know, and you've got the problem solved. But we're not going to do that.
You don't have to. You could only pay $10 an hour, $12. Yeah. We have 6.1% nationwide unemployment in California. In some counties, we have 15%. And some of the people who are hurt the most are Mexican-American legal citizens and also African-Americans and poor other minorities. So we haven't tried that yet by creating a normal border situation that would drive up the price of labor. One of the ironies is that many of the unions who are neutral on the issue are starting to change because they see that the people who are being hurt, as your caller, are people who are at the very end of the wage scale. It just has, the minimum wage has not kept up with inflation in California, especially because employers knew that there was always this pool of undocumented workers who would have to work for less. So the people who are hurt are not just the state at large, but people without educations who usually use physical type of labor that are so-called unskilled. They can't compete.
Brian, let me just go back to Brian, if I can. Brian, I mean, would you have the government close off the border so the wages would automatically go up? Would that?
Well, see, I don't know what the best solution would be. You know, I really don't know enough about the situation. It's just that, you know, working in a kitchen to some people is considered unskilled labor. But when you go to school to learn, you know, French classical techniques, it's not unskilled labor. It's highly skilled labor. And yet anyone who's eaten in a restaurant in America, I guarantee, has had food prepared for them by illegal aliens.
Brian, thanks so much for your call.
Thank you.
1-800-423-8255 for you to join us in this conversation about immigration from Mexico, the effect on the job market, and what the options are for people on both sides of the issue. Is America prepared to do what it would really take to control that border with Mexico, or is that the proper direction to head anyway? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. With me this hour, Victor Davis Hanson. He's author of a book called Mexifornia, A State of Becoming, and writes a biweekly column for National Review Online. And Ricardo Pimentel is also with us. He's a syndicated columnist writing about social justice, Latino issues, and other matters for the Arizona Republic. As I said, our number is 1-800-423-TALK. Going straight back to the lines now. And Iowa City, Iowa, Pat's on the line. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I'm calling about the meatpacking industry and how it has contributed to a problem of illegal immigration and paying very, very low wages for very, very hard labor.
Tell me how it's changed.
Well, in the 70s, meatpacking jobs typically paid $12 an hour.
That was union work or non-union work?
Both.
Yeah.
And now the same jobs pay $7 to $8 an hour.
And who's doing it now?
Mexican-Americans primarily, and some Somalis. And they've also increased...
And Pat, did you lose a job in that business? I mean, is that why you know about it?
No. I'm a veterinarian.
Okay.
But I grew up in a community that had a kill plant. And people didn't lose jobs. They basically chose not to work for those wages. It was people opting out of the jobs because it progressively paid such an unlivable wage. Plus, the kill rate on the floors rose from 250 head per hour to 400 head per hour. So there was an increasing carpal tunnel syndrome, increasing injuries at work. The jobs just became unbearable, and most of the local people were not willing to work there anymore.
And are you saying that you know, this is an example of capitalism working?
It's an example of capitalism not working. It's big companies like IBP, the big packers, who I think basically promote illegal immigration for their own use, for their own bottom line.
Pat, let me turn to Ricardo Pimentel on this, because, Ricardo, a lot of the criticism of illegal immigrants comes back, as it did in Brian's conversation and with Pat, to, you know, people who are willing to work for wages so low that the business itself is off-kilter. Do you know what I mean?
Sure, I do. But why not turn it around? We have companies willing to pay that low and unable to find Americans to work for that low a pay and working that hard. You know, why vilify the immigrant and let the corporation go unscathed? If you don't want immigrants, don't create the jobs that require them. And if you don't want...
But isn't the main criticism against the government for allowing so many immigrants in that there's people, you know, hanging out, willing to work for low wages?
Letting them? I'm not sure if your solution, if a solution, is militarizing the border, closing the border. I don't think that's a workable solution. There's not a way you can patrol 2,000 miles of border. That, you know, and if you did, all of the business circles that government listens to would be in an uproar.
Okay, but
it's just not practical.
Does Mexico become another state? What would you recommend?
Well, you know, I would look at the European Union model. Many years ago, there were weak potential members of the EU, and there were stronger ones. The stronger ones helped the weaker ones catch up. Those weaker ones, like Spain and Portugal, were exporters of immigrants to the rest of Europe.
Victor, let me hear from you on this notion.
Well, your callers did not vilify the immigrant. They all vilified the corporations who are trying to cut expenses and maximize profits in a global economy.
Right.
The European model is not a good example because those were sovereign states that had guest worker programs. They are a good model if you look at the problems, the enormous social and economic problems France is having with unassimilated illegal aliens who come in from the Muslim North African countries, or England is dealing with, and all of the Europeans, in fact, are scrambling to try to go back to an assimilationist model and to legalize that problem. And the problem is simply that as long as corporations have to compete in a global society, they cut costs, and as long as the government winks at it, and as long as the Mexican government does not make fundamental social and economic change because its excess population is exported as human capital and then pays back remuneration, everybody benefits. The people who are the losers, of course, are the illegal aliens who have to do that terrible work under the conditions they do, and all the employers throw them as the bone that you're better off than Mexico, which is true in a sense.
So are
not
you,
true.
Are you saying, though, Victor, that the border itself can be?
I think it can be. I agree with Mr. Pimentel that it would be terrible to just deport people. I think that what we need to do is have a compromise where we extend amnesty to the people who have been here, say, 5, 10, 15 years, and then close the border and then give Mexico some special privileges because of its proximity, as we do Canada, but then limit immigration to, I don't know what it would be, 100, 150, 250,000 legal immigrants. And I think that it would be a radical shock, but it would have some long-term benefits both for Mexico, which would have reform, I think, foisted upon them, which is long overdue, and then we wouldn't have this problem with these two
classifications. And the temporary work permit thing that would allow
people
in?
That would be one way, but I don't like
that idea.
There's no reason why. I mean, we can pay more as Americans to make sure that people who pack meat and do that terrible job make $12 an hour. The biggest people it would help would be first-generation legal immigrants from Mexico.
Quickly, Ricardo, back to you. The idea of an amnesty for the people who are considered illegal, undocumented immigrants here in America?
All for it. I'm all for it. I think it's just a matter of simple justice.
And reducing the number of immigrants the way that Victor's suggesting. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out where the big gap is that separates the two of you.
In combination with a guest worker program, you could limit some immigration. If it doesn't take care of the economic need, it won't solve the problem. A devil is in the details with a guest worker program. Which industries do you anoint? Which ones don't you? Do you allow mobility within jobs? Do you allow folks to work their way to permanent residency, or is it just strictly temporary?
Right.
They have to live here as bachelors without their families. The devil is in the details.
Let me go to another call here. Diego's joining us now from Boston. Hi, Diego.
Good morning.
Thanks a lot for calling. This idea of the guest worker,
mm-hmm.
What do you think of that?
The guest worker program that exists in the U.S. now, with something called H-2A, is something where the workers within it have are more vulnerable to abuse than even undocumented workers. So I guess I would echo the saying that it really has to protect workers very carefully, or it does undermine the possibility of others. Can I say two things real quick?
Yeah, go ahead.
One is that this is a problem which isn't exclusive to the U.S. I've just come back from a number of years in Costa Rica, and Costa Rica has the same phenomena going on with Nicaraguans working in construction, domestic employment, agriculture, and they provide, they bring they subsidize those industries in Costa Rica, much as agriculture.
But are there examples there that would be useful for the United States?
Well, that it's a problem that's larger than our own. It's a structural problem. And it's really an issue the society needs to deal with, because I think it has a real corrupting influence on
Nobody's disagreeing with that. I'm just trying to figure out whether or not you
with it.
That it's a structural problem?
It's a corrupting problem. It is as enriching as it is corrupting.
All right. Yeah. I was going with the structural part of it.
The thing about undocumented employment is that an employer has an advantage and an incentive to hire undocumented workers, because an undocumented worker will work for less and will accept exploitative conditions because they need to, and that creates all kinds of distortions, human distortions, and I guess economic ones in our society.
Is that what you're talking about when you're talking about the corrupting influence? Then,
yeah, but yes, that's a piece of it. One thing that I'll go back to something.
Diego, you know what I'm going to do? I'm real tight on time here, and I do want to go back to both Victor and Ricardo here for some concluding comments. Ricardo, you haven't heard anything from people on the program that you haven't heard in your own writing, in your own research, in your own study of this. If you were to draw people's attention to one aspect of it and say, you know what you need to think about, you need to think about this, what would it be?
That immigrants become Americans, that there is a period of transition, that often it is painful, has problems attendant with it, but it mimics previous immigrant waves.
So you're saying we are here in 2003, exactly where the East Coast was in the early 1800s, with people saying, we don't want these Jews, we don't want these Poles, we don't want these Irish Catholics coming in.
It's exactly. Michael Barone, The New Americans, wrote The New Americans, and made a pretty good case that the Irish Italian experience is very much what we're making of the Latino experience, immigrant experience today.
And, Victor, this is something that you take note of in your book as well. What's different? Why do you think this is something that's unique, not comparable to the situation that Ricardo describes?
It's perhaps maybe the proximity of Mexico. It's not exactly the same. It's exactly the same in the generations who come over and stay here. That's true. But Ireland was a long way away, and so was Russia.
So why is that different? Why does that make the people who come from those countries different?
Because they have a psychological separation, and they're not totally replenished. If you were a Polish person who came in 1910, you looked at an early phone book, it would be in English, and then you would have no chance to have a Polish phone book, and you would have also the idea that Poles would not be coming. They came in waves, as the Irish did, and they were cut off.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the Cubans who came from Cuba. They did not come at a million a year. If Castro had been like Mexico and there had been unlimited immigration from Cuba, they would have the same problems. Cubans have a very different immigrant experience for a variety of reasons. But if we were to give amnesty to the people who are here and then have a radically new legal policy, then we would have the same situation as the Jews and the Italians, and we would have no problems really to speak of within 15 or 20 years. I agree with Roberto that my students who are Mexican Americans, within 15 years, there's no difference between other minority groups. But the problem is we keep bringing in 2 to 3 million a year undocumented, and we have an apartheid community where I live. We have whole towns where there's not a single non-illegal alien or Mexican-American who live in them.
Ricardo,
it's not healthy for us.
Can you see a time when the shadow of 9/11 allows this debate to be held in the way that it was the summer of 2001?
Yeah, I think we'll get there. I think we'll get to a situation where we can discern between terrorists and dishwashers. I think we need to get there.
And we're not now.
No, we're not. We're not. It is a national security is a very real concern. I would doubt that everyone is as concerned about national security as they were about
right.
the
Victor, quick last comment
reasons.
To you. Can we get past the shadow of 9/11 to a place where this debate was earlier?
I think if we're honest and we're controlled and we're not emotional on either side, my problem when I discuss this is I usually talk to some employer or some La Raza Studies professor and they go off in some emotional rant. And the discourse in between, as we've had today, is very rare.
Victor, thanks for being with us on the program
Thank
today.
You.
Victor Davis Hanson is the author of Mexifornia, State of Becoming. Ricardo, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Ricardo Pimentel is a columnist and a member of the editorial board at the Arizona Republic. Earlier in the hour, we talked with Chris Simcox, founder of Civil Homeland Defense, Tombstone, Arizona. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
This is WBUR. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Nextel, offering Nextel Direct Connect, the digital walkie-talkie feature in all Nextel phones that lets one get right through with the push of a button. Nextel, how business gets done. Nextel.com. ThoughtForms, custom builders located in Acton, celebrating 30 years of building new houses, renovations, and additions. Their work can be viewed at thoughtforms-corp.com. And Lala Roque on Beacon Hill, serving home-style Persian.